Welcome to the podcast that helps you build wealth and thrive in a world of out-of-control central banks and big governments. This is the Rebel Capitalist Show.
Hello, fellow Rebel Capitalists. Hope you're well. First off, I'd like to encourage all of you to check out Rebel Capitalist Pro. The world is changing very, very quickly. There's a lot of activity geopolitically, obviously. And there's never been a time, I think, in our lives where we need to be more cognizant of what is happening on the macroeconomic environment to make sure that we're setting up our portfolio in a way where we're managing risk, but then we're taking advantage of opportunities. And this is exactly what we do in Rebel Capitalist Pro. You can go to georgegammon.com/pro. So just a peek underneath the hood here. It's basically live streams from pros where it's just members asking questions. So you got people like me in there, believe it or not. You can see that. You got Jason Hartman on residential real estate. You got Lynn Alden on macro. You got Tony Greer. It also has Lynn Alden's personal, a couple of her personal portfolios that you can check out, see what she's buying. Tony Greer for trading, Chris McIntosh, macro, commodities, Patrick Sresna, options, Brent Johnson, macro. And I didn't even know we had a podcast. Well, look at that. That's cool. But one of the things I like most about Rebel Capitalist Pro, I'm going to finish this really quick here, guys, and we'll get into the questions, is this search thing. So if, let's say that you're interested in oil, so then what this does, I've got a gal, one of my editors, and she takes every single live stream and then breaks it down by keyword and then question and then answer from the pro. So here we've got Chris, this is from Chris McIntosh. And so the question is, what would provide the most leverage to the price of oil, a basket of oil service companies, or a basket of non-woke, non-ESG actual oil companies? So this is a question that someone asked Chris. So then what the editor does is, and there she is right there, Maria, the editor. She'll go ahead and take this answer and just cut it into a little bite-sized clip. So this is one of the features that I like the most about Rebel Capitalist Pro. But that's it for the pitch tonight, guys. Just wanted to take you and show you one thing underneath the hood there. So check that out at georgegammon.com/pro. And never a better time to take advantage of some insights, wisdom, and experience and the research from the people that we all enjoy following on FinTwit and on Real Vision, etc. Okay, getting into the questions. Okay, ruble USD going from 155 to 114, significant pullback. Well, it's just, I think, the central bank in Russia taking rates to 20%. I think that's kind of sinking into the market. And initially, they're, you know, everyone's panic selling ruble assets, which is making the ruble crash. I think a lot of that was panic over SWIFT. And when cooler heads prevailed, so to speak, I think they said, well, wait a minute here. This SWIFT doesn't affect them that much. And the central bank took rates to 20%. And it's true, they've got their FX reserves frozen. But they've got a lot of gold. And I think that's why you're seeing it go from 155 to 114, where it kind of settles down. I mean, who knows? Depends a lot on kind of the news that's coming out of Russia or Ukraine, or, you know, if you trust any of those news sources, which I don't trust the Russian news sources, and I don't trust the U.S. news sources, but I try to read them both, because I had a conversation with Jim Rogers the other night, and that's what he suggested. I asked him point blank. I said, Jim, when you're doing all of this research on countries like not just what's happening with Russia and Ukraine right now, but China or South, North Korea, Myanmar, Turkey, Zimbabwe, Venezuela, how do you sift through all the propaganda to find out the truth? And he simply said, well, George, that's a great question. You've got to look at just multiple news sources in different countries and realize that it's all propaganda and it's all BS. And once you've read all of the news sources, not all, but let's say four or five different news sources on the same topic from different countries, he said, then you can kind of build up some spidey senses to know and distill the truth out of all of the individual countries and media outlets' propaganda. And so I think that's what I'm doing right now. And I would suggest all of you doing the same. Because, again, just like I'm saying with Rebel Capitalist Pro, at no point in time do you need to be more educated and leverage the experience of the professionals. But also, at no point in time is it harder to know what the truth is. Where should I look to see if the credit markets are freezing up? Well, credit spreads, probably. I think that's, I'm not an expert there, and I haven't done too many videos on the topic, but I would look for credit spreads or anomalies. Spike, go back to repo in 2019. We all know that it spiked up into almost 10%. That's a huge anomaly. So I'd look for stuff like that in credit markets. Understanding, though, that I think the Fed has got their eye on that. And I think they're watching that like a hawk, because I think they're smart enough to know that at the end of the day, that's probably what's most important. And so I don't know if I'd look to play that directly, just because I think they'll backstop it like they did in March 2020. But that's kind of how I'd look at it. But take that with a grain of salt, Harrison, because I have not researched that to the extent or thought through that to the extent that I've thought through a lot of other things that I discussed on my whiteboard videos. I know Lynn has looked into that a lot. So if you're not following her on Twitter, I would do that. Or you can join Rebel Capitalist Pro and ask her directly. Sorry, guys. I'm in my salesman mood tonight. question, do you think gold is cheap at these levels? Should we consider holding medium long-term T-bills? Well, I don't think there's such a thing as a long-term T-bill, because by definition, a T-bill is going to be under or maximum year maturity. But I'm hoping, Brendan, you're not asking me medium or long-term treasuries, because that I would say not just no, but hell no. You should not. Well, I can't give you any personal investment advice, but I can't. Unless you're a player, unless you're a huge pool of money, pension fund, hedge fund, a primary dealer, a bank that needs to have dollar assets to match up with dollar liabilities. If you're just an average Joe and Jane like me, or like most people on this live stream, there is no way that I would hold medium or long-term treasuries, if that's your question. Even against a recession, I'd hold T-bills against a recession, but that would be like 1 month, 3 months, something like that. So then your first question is, gold cheap? It's a tough question. It depends on how you measure it. Maybe, are you measuring against M2? Then yes. Are you measuring it against itself or its own price adjusted for inflation? If so, maybe I wouldn't call it cheap, but I don't look at gold as cheap and expensive. It's like saying, is insurance cheap? Well, I don't know, but you want to have it just in case you get in a car wreck. And especially the way the world is set up right now, geopolitically, like we were talking about at the beginning of the live stream, I just can't even imagine not owning gold. That said, nor can I imagine having 100% gold. So for me, it's about 10%. Someone asked me in Rebel Capitalist Pro during the Pro live stream last week if I felt as though it might be wise to, instead of go 10%, maybe 15% for my own portfolio. I said, that's something I'd probably consider right now, just because it does give you liquidity. But keep in mind that if you're someone that believes the stock market has a lot of downside risk, a lot of downside tail risk, let's say, gold is going to tank because it does have liquidity. So if credit markets seize up, going back to our first or second question there, because people are just going to sell whatever's on their balance sheet that they can sell, where they're going to sell whatever they can get a bid for. And I think that would include gold and Bitcoin. Now, I think that's a long-term buying opportunity, but I wouldn't buy gold right now thinking that it's just going to go straight up for the next 5 years. Nothing goes up in a straight line. And I just keep that in mind. But then I'd also keep in mind that maybe gold isn't something you would own to get rich. Maybe it's something that you just own as a really good hedge, as insurance. If we have central bank digital currency, Will we have the ability to buy gold, silver, cryptos? Or no, I don't think they'll ban those. Now, with cryptos, I think it's a little different. It depends. And this is what's so ironic about the people that are kind of the Bitcoin maxis. As long as Bitcoin stays a digital asset or a digital reserve asset, or, you know, if you want to call it digital gold, I don't think it's really digital gold yet, but as long as it stays a digital asset, I don't think it'll be banned. You got to look at the mindset of the people at the Fed or in the government. They're all Keynesians, the people who know anything about economics. Most of them don't know. They can't even pronounce Keynesian. But the people that do know anything about economics, most of them are of that school of thought where they're going to put 100% of the emphasis on aggregate demand. So why would you take away something that increases aggregate demand, assuming that Bitcoin goes up? You wouldn't. You'd want to keep anything that leads to more aggregate demand. That's what you would want. I think it's a different question if Bitcoin becomes currency. If Bitcoin becomes a currency, then I think there's, you know, they can't ban it every single time. You know, it's such a boring question too, or it's such a boring, tedious answer. I think that you hear on social media whenever someone says, do you think they'll pass a law banning owning Bitcoin? You know, every single Bitcoiner responds, oh, you can't ban Bitcoin. Oh, you can't ban Bitcoin. And they call you the idiot. Like, yeah, I get it. You can't ban Bitcoin. I'm clear on that, Chief. But what you can do is say, if you're caught owning it, that's 10 years in prison. And if they do that, then how many people are going to own it? Now, not everyone's going to sell it, but a large majority of the people, especially the pension funds. I mean, there's going to be mass selling of Bitcoin there. But as long as it stays, that's the irony, is that the maxis, I think, want it to become currency so badly. And the higher the probability it becomes a currency, the bigger the target I think Bitcoin has on its back. So I think, me personally, I think everyone should own Bitcoin to have some purchasing power outside the banking system. But I hope it stays just a digital asset, just for my own portfolio. 3-month price for gold. Oh, I don't know. Who knows? I mean, if I just had to venture a guess, I'd say higher, but who knows? I mean, you can't tell. I don't think anyone can really predict what's going to happen in the short run with any asset. I think 3 years, you can have a good idea of the probabilities, but 3 months, who knows? But if I had to guess, I'd just say probably higher. If I had to guess how high, I'd say, 3 months. Actually, though, now I'm second guessing that, because 3 months, it just all depends on Russia, Ukraine. Let me put it to you this way. If you think that Russia and Ukraine will be settled, let's say in the next 3 weeks, you know, 3 weeks, months, something like that, I would say gold lower in 3 months. If you think Russia, Ukraine is still going to be, you know, going back and forth and escalating, and then maybe the US gets involved and that escalates, then 3 month price higher. So it really depends on your outlook there. As far if it does end, obviously we're all praying that it ends yesterday. We're praying that it ends as soon as possible. But assuming that it does end, why would I say lower? Because then I think you're going to get some, you know, the Fed's going to be raising rates. What does the stock market do? Yield curve is flattening. Eurodollar future curve inverting. Oil price at 100, and, let's say 10, 120, you know, it might go down to 90, 95, but still that's high. That's going to be very, I don't want to use the word deflationary, but that's going to put a lot of headwinds to markets. And that may drop gold, like we were saying. So that's kind of my just thinking out loud there. Okay, so Ron is saying Russian oil or Russian Luke oil. Yes, I bought Luke oil, but Ron, let's be clear here, my friend. I never recommended anyone to buy anything. I don't give recommendations. If you can find where I came out and said, hey, I think everyone should buy Luke oil, you're not going to find that. So let's be very clear, and I try to be as clear as I possibly can on these live streams, that this is just what I'm thinking about. This is what I've got on a watch list. This is what I am doing. I am not recommending anyone buy anything, especially not something that risky. But even if it was the safest bet on earth, I still wouldn't recommend anyone buying anything. That's not what I do. What do you think the probability of Russia selling their oil for gold is, as Luke Groman states? Also, any plans of getting Luke on your show? Yeah, Luke's on the show Wednesday. Good timing. So obviously, when I heard his podcast with Grant Williams, well, even before then, when I heard, I think the podcast he did was, I want to give them a shout out. It was Palisades Radio. You guys probably know that show. I think that's it. They did a great podcast with Luke. And then Luke did a podcast over the weekend. At least that's when it came out with Grant. And that was incredible. Incredible. If you haven't listened to that one, you guys have to. And so when I heard him on Palisades Radio, I had my assistant call him up. And then when I heard him over the weekend with Grant, then I wrote down about another 50 questions that I want to ask him. So I'm really looking forward to that. And I think what I'm going to do is, after I speak with him on Wednesday, I'm probably going to do Thursday whiteboard video around our conversation on Wednesday. So I'm super excited for that. Are cash deposits considered unsecured liabilities? Yes. Yes. Ask Russia. They're finding out the hard way that your dollars or your cash, quote unquote, is not a green piece of paper. It's not a red piece of paper. It's not a yellow piece of paper. It's simply a liability of a bank. And they can give that back to you or not. They have the power and the control to do that, which is why I say, regardless of price, I like to own a little gold. I like to own a little Bitcoin. And I like to own some diesel trucks. And I like to own a couple Rolexes just to have some purchasing power outside of the banking system that isn't someone else's liability. And people laugh at me for those diesel trucks, but you should see what I bought those things for and what they're valued at today. That's probably the best investment I've ever made as far as how much they've actually appreciated in price. But yeah, well, there's diesel trucks or Rolex watches or gold or Bitcoin or silver, something like that. You got to have something that's not someone else's liability, or at least that's the way I think. Is the war crisis doing the job of the central banks, energy and commodity prices serving as a demand killer? I think it's giving them an excuse, that's for sure. And Ron Paul had a great article on this. I think Zero Hedge republished it the other day. The title of the article was, "Is Putin the Next Coronavirus?" And Ron Paul beautifully went through all of the incentives that I have been talking about since the invasion here. How is the media incentivized? How are the politicians incentivized? How are the central bankers incentivized? And you've got to remember, the Fed was backed up into a corner where, what do you do? Do you raise interest rates and potentially crash the market? Or do you not raise interest rates and let inflation run hot when all the politicians are going to call you every day and yell and scream at you for not controlling inflation because they know they're not going to get reelected? Now, all of a sudden, you've got a great excuse. Oh, well, we can't raise rates now. Of course not. I mean, it's not our fault. It's Putin's fault. It's those damn Russians. And I say that with all due respect to Russian people that have absolutely nothing to do with what's going on with Putin. And I say that as in a sympathetic way, because so many Russian people are being targeted just for no reason, just like we did with the Japanese back in World War II. It's absolutely ridiculous. And it's, a lot of the pushback you get is, oh, well, George, who cares if we're not allowing some 16-year-olds to play hockey in Canada? It's not as bad as what's happening to the Ukrainians. Like, that's an argument, right? Supporting Ukraine is one of these things. Do we really need to outwardly say that we're against that? Obviously, everyone is against that. Every single person. Find me a person that's actually for Ukraine being invaded. I mean, find me that person, right, in the West or on, find me that says, hey, this is a great idea. I'm so glad that Putin invaded Ukraine. No, that's like saying I'm against cancer. I mean, yeah, so am I. Talk about something that is, just that you're not going to get any pushback on at all. as non-controversial as you can find. But my point there is that just because we hurt Russians, it doesn't help Ukrainians. And obviously we want this to end. Obviously what's happening in Ukraine is a humanitarian crisis. It's a tragedy, and it's just horrific. But that said, we don't want to create another humanitarian crisis by going into this world where we've got McCarthyism 2.0. And just by saying that, well, by being inhumane to Russians that have nothing to do with what's going on in Ukraine, well, that's not as bad as what the Ukrainians are. Just take that to its logical conclusion, right? And we know the suffering that's happening in Ukraine. So what if we just start putting Russians in camps like we did with the Japanese back in World War II? I mean, you could have that same argument. Well, George, that's not as bad as what the Ukrainians are dealing with. Right, but does that mean that we should round them up and put them in camps? I mean, take it a step further. What if we just beat them mercifully or unmercifully? Well, George, well, that's not as bad as what the Ukrainians are doing. See, so where does that end, right? And obviously that's a very, very slippery slope. So I'm someone that is very for the people, regardless of the color of their skin, regardless of their ethnicity, regardless of what arbitrary line in the sand they just happen to be born in. I'm against governments. And let's be clear, it's not the Russian people that are going to war, just like it wasn't the Americans, for the most part, who were going to war in Iraq. It wasn't the Americans who were going to war in Afghanistan. Most of them were opposed to the war in Afghanistan. A lot of people, obviously Vietnam, I mean, go back, right? So you can't just say that it's all, just lump all Russians together, just like you can't lump all Americans together. And we should know that, you know, it's just tribalism. It's the way we're hardwired as human beings, unfortunately. But we have to know that that's one of our weaknesses as a species. And we have to make sure that we're not making egregious errors because of that imperfection. And we got to look back at our history and say, okay, what mistakes did we make? Well, let's not make those in the future. And rounding up Japanese people and putting them into camps, that was probably a mistake. And just like, you know, I'm not saying that we're doing that now, but that's the path we are on with Russians. And, you know, whether it's renaming the Moscow Mule at bars, whether it's banning performers from performing in New York City. You know, we had one politician in California suggest that he wanted to expel and deport all of the Russian students in American universities. Yeah, that's not a slippery slope. We had, you know, certain symphonies that are canceling concerts and shows because there's a symphony that was, you know, by a Russian composer or something like that. I mean, this is insanity. This is absolute insanity. And to think that this somehow helps Ukraine is just, it's madness. The only thing it does is hurt innocent Russians. Two wrongs don't make a right. So I'm not sure how I got off on that tangent. I apologize. So let's keep going here with the questions. Can stagflation and recession simultaneously manifest? Sure. That's what, in a way, that's kind of the definition of stagflation. And what might that look like? It's the 70s. And basically, you've just got negative real GDP growth. So Owen, what happens is, let's say you've got nominal GDP growth at 10%. Okay, but we've got 11% inflation. What that means is we've got negative 1% real GDP growth, although nominal is at 10%. That would be a recession while we have high rates of inflation. So that's, you know, if you look at the 1970s, we had periods in there that were recessionary while the CPI was still very high. Therefore, nominal GDP was high. But when you deduct the rate of inflation, again, you've got negative or a contraction in the actual economy. You got to remember that the economic output is the measurement of how well the economy is doing. The prices are not. All GDP does is just aggregate the prices of all the stuff that was bought and sold over the year, basically. So if the price of that stuff goes up, it doesn't mean that we're richer. It doesn't mean that we're producing more stuff. It doesn't mean that we are more productive. It just means the prices went up. So what we need to be worried about is how productive we are. How much stuff are we producing? how much economic output was there? And so that's why we want to make sure that we're focusing on real GDP growth and not just nominal. The only group that wins with nominal GDP growth only is the government. So yeah, high inflation, negative real GDP growth, and high rates of unemployment. Oh, maybe that's how I got off on that question. It's the probability of Russia selling their oil for gold. I would say over what time frame? I mean, are we talking about the next 2 months or the next 2 years? The next 2 years, when I first heard Luke on Palisades Radio, if that's what it's called, I would give it 5%, 10%. After I heard him with Grant, 20%, looking at a five-year time horizon, trying to find a neutral reserve asset that is not an SDR, going back to Keynes and Bancor, which would be Bretton Woods. This is something I know a lot of very powerful people have discussed in the past. Usually they bring it up as an SDR, but could that be oil? Could that be gold? Possibly. See, I need to talk to Luke about that. And this is one of the things that I'm really excited about asking him, is the whole point is, or one of the main issues is Russia and China and other countries, they have to have dollars. Or like a Japan, they have to have dollars. So they have to run a trade surplus. If they don't have the dollars, then they can't get the oil because the oil is priced in dollars. So basically they have a constraint, but gold, they still have a constraint. I guess I'm trying to maybe put words in Luke's mouth and I don't want to do that, but I'll be fascinated to hear what he says. But my guess is he'd say that gold is outside of the control of a foreign government where the dollar to a certain degree is not. And that's why, although gold constrains them, as does the dollar, because they can't print dollars, nor can they print gold, given the choice between the two, they would prefer gold because, again, it's outside of the control of a government that could be hostile towards you in the future. But you'll have to tune in Wednesday night to hear what he says. Okay, what do you make of Zero Hedge article? India mulling rupee ruble payment system, beginning another challenging dollar. Listen, I'd be surprised if they didn't. What would you got to put yourself in the shoes of one of these countries? Let's just say that you were China. And what would you be doing? I mean, if you were India and you were seeing what the United States is doing by freezing the Russian central bank's FX reserves, what would you do? Would you just sit back and say, whatever. Doesn't affect me. Boy, it sucks to be those Russians. I mean, hell no. You're looking at that and going, whoa, I did not think that was possible. Okay, I need to make sure that we are never in Russia's position in the future. Are we getting along with the United States well right now? Sure. Does that mean that we're going to be getting along with them well in 5 years? Who knows? Do I want to take that risk? Absolutely not. I was reading somewhere, and this is, I think this is something I was talking to Jim Rogers about the other night. I don't know where I heard it. It might have been on a podcast. But they said that after we dropped the bomb on Hiroshima in World War II, many of our allies started their own nuclear program. Why? Because they said, you know, we're in good standings with the United States right now, but if they're willing to do that to Japan, how do we know they're not going to do that to us in 10 years, 15 years, 20 years? Who knows? So because of what we did to Japan, this prompted other countries that otherwise probably would not have gone down that path to start developing their own nuclear programs. And it's one of these unintended consequences that we talk about all the time. And it goes back to what we always say with Dr. Thomas Sowell teaches us. It's about cost benefit. And then Hazlitt teaches us, you know, even if you do a cost benefit, most people do it with the seen and they forget to do it with the unseen. They look at just what's on the surface, or the first, I forgot what that's called, but they just look at the first action. And they don't look at the second reaction, the third, fourth, and fifth. It's like that ripple effect in the pond. They just focus on where the stone lands and they don't think about the ripples. that are created as a result of throwing that stone in the water. And I think, and a lot of others are, I've heard them express this thought, that the West, the United States, Europe, whatever, what they did by freezing Russia's FX account or FX reserves, that is throwing that stone into the pond. That is the financial Hiroshima. And just like that prompted our allies and other, even countries that were not our allies, to develop their own nuclear program, I think that what they did to the Russian central bank, whether it was right or wrong, completely separate topic. But I think that's going to prompt other countries to develop their own way around, so they will not be susceptible to this, or at least they'll have a way to fight back in the future if they are ever in the crosshairs of the United States. So to answer your question, this does not surprise me. It would surprise me if they weren't mulling over a rupee ruble payment system.
Hey guys, I want to remind you to get your tickets to Rebel Capitalist Live. This is the live conference I do twice per year with all of your favorite speakers from the Rebel Capitalist Show and experts in investing, commodities, real estate, freedom, and liberty. All of your favorite topics, all of your favorite speakers. The next Rebel Capitalist Live is going to be in Miami, and tickets increase in price as we get closer to the event. So go to rebelcapitalistlive.com right now to get your tickets to the next Rebel Capitalist Live. It's the conference you cannot afford to miss. It'll help you increase your financial freedom and, more importantly, your personal freedom. You'll get intel that you won't hear anywhere else. Past speakers have included icons in macroeconomics, investing, and personal freedom and liberty. People like Dr. Ron Paul, Robert Kiyosaki, Brent Johnson, Lynn Alden, Jeff Snyder, Richard Werner, Mark Moss, Lynette Zhang, and Robert Breedlove, just to name a few. So once again, go to Rebel Capitalist Live right now and get your tickets today.
What is your opinion about owning commodities, mining stocks in a global reset? Well, guys, I've been listening to a book, an audio book, all weekend, and I'll show you which one it is. I'd love to promote this any way I can. And I think I'm almost done with it. But this is the book that I have been listening to all weekend. It's Jim Rogers, Hot Commodities. So this is a book that he wrote in 2004. And most of you know what commodities did from 1998 to 2011 or so. I'd also like to point out that in this book, Jim talks about the index fund he set up for commodities. He set that up in 1998. Go ahead and pull up a chart of commodities and look at when they bottomed out. You'll see that it just happened to be 1998 when Jim Rogers set up his fund to not buy tech stocks, not buy .com this or .com that, but to buy pork bellies, to buy orange juice, to buy gold, to buy oil. I don't know if he was buying coal, but those are some of the commodities that I heard him talk about specifically. This is what Jim Rogers was doing in 1998. And when you pull up a chart of commodities, you will instantly learn a lesson, a very good lesson. In the book, he also talks about the real estate market being in a bubble. He talks about the commodity cycle ending in 2015 to 2022. So he got that wrong by a couple years. But boy, oh boy, did he get the cycle right. That's for sure. And the other projections that he gives in the book, you know, he nails like 90% of what actually came to fruition. The timing a little off here and there, but overall just nails it. So what's my point? A lot of the arguments that Jim Rogers was giving for a commodities bull run in 2004, and he started talking about this in 1998, is very consistent with what we see happening right now. The only difference, or not the only, but the main difference is that back then China was just growing by leaps and bounds as far as their economy. And as you guys know from watching my videos in Evergrande, we could go into a time frame when China's economy is pulling back a bit and they're not consuming as many commodities as they were maybe in, but maybe they are though. Maybe they are. Let me take that back, because you've got to think about the size of China's economy back in 2004. And although it was growing quickly, it probably was still smaller, therefore less demand for commodities than China's economy today, even if they had a 10% pullback. You know, even if they had a recession where their economy contracted by 10%, still probably using more commodities than they were using back in 2004, even if they're growing at 10% back then. So that was one of his main arguments, is that, you know, supply demand, and then supply, no one's investing in it, just like we don't see anyone investing really in commodities today, which is why we're seeing oil at 130, why you're seeing nat gas at these all-time highs, because this was persona non grata. As Jim Cramer said on CNBC, oil is uninvestable. And he said that back when it was like 40 or whatever, because of ESG. Coal, another thing, uninvestable. Well, whenever you're buying things, and I, again, this is not a, I'm not suggesting you do this, but I'm saying, just based on my research, whenever you're buying things that are quote unquote uninvestable, or you're buying things where everyone is telling you that you're absolutely out of your mind, I think it's worth looking into. I know in my life, in my investment journey, and I'm just a noob, I'm a rookie, I'm an amateur, but I just, you know, I didn't know anything before 2012. That's when I retired and started investing for myself, and I started off in real estate. But I think the main thing there is not only investing in what you know, but every time that I've invested in something that other people thought was insane, I've made the most amount of money. Every time I've invested in something where people thought that was a great idea, those are the only times that I came close to losing money. So point is, try to invest in something you know at the point in time when people are telling you that you're absolutely crazy. And I think there could be a lot of opportunities that we see in the next year or 2 years where people are telling you that you're absolutely crazy. And I think that it's hard to pull the trigger from a psychological standpoint, but that's what everyone was telling Jim Rogers back in 1998. But I kind of got off on a tangent there. I apologize. My main thing to point out was, look at a chart of commodity cycles going back to the 1800s. And what you'll see is the up cycle to the overall, you know, up then back down, is usually about 15 years. So assuming that we have another commodity cycle, like we have had commodity cycles going back to the 1800s in the United States, then we could say that there's a high probability that this super cycle lasts another maybe at least 10 years. Say we're 2 years into it. I think if you're going to try to find a starting point, maybe March 2020, or maybe when oil got to negative $38 a barrel, my guess is when we look back in 20 years, that was probably the low. that started the next uptrend on the super cycle. And so I'm not saying go out and buy commodities now, but what I am personally doing, Pedro, is just saying, what commodities would I like to own for the next 10 years, putting them on a watch list, and then just waiting until I see some panic in those commodities and then buy. And that's what I'm doing. I'm not saying it's right for you. I'm not suggesting anyone do that, but that's kind of how I see it in my mind. And I would strongly suggest you guys reading or listening to that audio book, or that book from Jim Rogers, Hot Commodities. The whole book is awesome. And you'll hear a lot of similarities between what was happening back then and at kind of the earlier stages of that super cycle. You'll hear a lot of similarities, or read a lot of similarities, between what was happening then and what is happening now. The probability of the dollar losing status, global reserve status, Well, what's your time frame? I mean, 20 years, I'd say 50-50. 5 years, 5% maybe. And how would you even define that? I mean, let's go back and look at when other countries have lost the reserve status. It doesn't just happen overnight. It takes like decades to play out. It just happens very slowly and gradually. People just start using other currencies, and the amount of global transactions that are settled in the British pound or the dollar or whatever, it just kind of gradually goes down. It's not this, the United States, you know, the dollar is the reserve currency today and next week it's not. That's not. You've got to remember that it's not just the dollar that's the global reserve currency. It's the dollar infrastructure and it's the banks. And this is another thing that I'm going to talk to Luke about, because Luke's view, or at least the view he expressed to Brent, is very central bank government centric. Now, I know Snyder would most likely say, okay, I get it, but what we use as a reserve currency, it's not really up to the central planners. It's up to the banksters. So do the banksters want the dollar to be the global reserve currency? The answer there is unequivocally yes. Why? Because since Bretton Woods, or since the 1950s more specifically, the banksters have figured out a way, or not just a way, many, 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 many ways to profit from the Eurodollar system. In other words, to make mind-boggling profits from this infrastructure that is the dollar monetary system. You know, whether we talk about SWIFT, whether we talk about Basel III, you talk about all these things that are supposed to constrain the banks to a certain degree, or the clearinghouse, you know, chips or whatever. And I'm talking about the infrastructure there. The banks have figured out how to use this system to their advantage. We talk about it through balance sheet management with derivatives, dollar derivatives, and then counterparty risk. And the banks are in a position where they're completely unconstrained. They can create as many dollars as they want. Therefore, they can almost create as much profit as they want, assuming that they can manage their balance sheet and that there's very low counterparty risk. Now, that counterparty risk goes up and they can't, that's going to limit their ability to profit, because it's going to limit their ability to leverage their balance sheet. So how many of those banksters are going to say, oh yeah, the gold-backed ruble? Sure, let's do it. Why not? How many of those banksters are going to say, oh, the Indian rupee, or a gold-backed currency between Russia, China, and India? Fantastic idea. That's going to reduce our profits by 90%, but yeah, let's do it. So you think JP Morgan's going to be on board with that? You think Deutsche Bank? You think that HSBC? No way. Absolutely no way. So you've got to think this through. You've got competing factions here, competing groups. It's not just the politicians and the central banks. It's the banksters as well. And the banksters' incentives might not be directly aligned with the authoritarians, Putin, the Xi Jinping, the Modis, or the Jerome Powells, or the World Economic Forum. There's a lot of different power players that have entrenched interests, let's say. And we need to be cognizant of that if we're trying to truly figure out the probability of the dollar losing reserve currency status. So that's why I give it a 5-10% within 5 years or so. Most people would say, oh, George, you're crazy. You're crazy with what's happening in Russia. You know, they're going to go to another system, just like we were saying with India. And I completely agree. They're going to try to go that direction. They're going to try to set up ways around this and around that. But that's one cross current. The other cross current is you've got the entrenched interests of the banksters. How does that play out? I don't know. But we've got to think of all parties involved here.
Hey guys, I want to remind you to check out Rebel Capitalist Pro. This is the incredible online investment forum that I have with investment experts Lynn Alden and Chris McIntosh. It includes professionals such as Patrick Serezna from Macro Voices. He specializes in options. Tony Greer, commodity trading. Jason Hartman, real estate. And Brent Johnson with Macroeconomics. If you want to build wealth and thrive in this world of out-of-control central banks and big governments, Rebel Capitalist Pro is the resource you need. So check it out today at georgegammon.com/pro. That's georgegammon.com/pro. We'll see you inside with the fellow Rebel Capitalists that are taking their investing to the next level.
Now let's get into some shout outs. Who do we have here on the live stream? We have Jorge Guzman, Countdown to Ecstasy. All right. All righty then. Mitch Goslin, Boy Brow, Mike Brady, Sustainable Lumber Company in the house, All Nighter Hider in the house, Ganime, Panda Bear, Bombastic Bushkin, okay, Alan Zibelman, Malaysia, Numismatic, Chris Sauer, Faust, Minky7, RR, Mike Horseman, Bull Dag, Mike S, Andrew McDonald, Canada, Jared H. Smith, Active Greed, James Bunch, Jakob Wenham, XRP Bankster, Cyphorid, Joe Wetton. All right, guys, enjoy the rest of your evening. As always, make sure that you're standing up for freedom, liberty, free market capitalism. We'll see you on the next video.
Thank you for listening to the Rebel Capitalist Show. For more content like this, check out the Rebel Capitalist blog at georgegammon.com or go to the George Gammon YouTube channel.